everybody. It's July 16th, 2020. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks so much for listening. Okay, we do appreciate it, as does my guest, Ron Miller. Ron is a former teacher, and he's from Camden, New Jersey, right across the river from where I grew up in Philadelphia. Okay, I'm sure he knows Philly quite well. He's a former teacher, he's an after-school program director, he's an author, he's a freelance writer, he has a great blog called Urban Ed Mixtape, urbanedmixtape.com. It's pretty darn good stuff over there, I got to tell you. He's won some awards for that. And among other things today with him, we're going to talk about cultural competency in education, which I think is really, really important these days. And it, actually, I think it's incredibly important considering with the death of George Floyd and all that sort of thing and how that has erupted and overturned a bit of society. All good stuff, we hope, in the end, all right, that something good comes out of this disaster. And, you know, with the pandemic, it's given us time to think about that, and hopefully we can make something happen. And Ron's going to be talking about with us in just a couple of seconds. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org. We'll tweet it out over at EduTalk Radio. We Facebook over at EduTalk Radio, and also my name, Larry Jacobs. And then we link in over at Larry Jacobs if you want to link or friend or follow or whatever we do. Please, we have the American Consortium for Equity in Education. That's ace-ed.org. That's where it lives, ace-ed.org. Also over there, and please, you're welcome to join our consortium. It's free, like everything we do. We're just trying to get a voice in there for educators and the industry to come together, okay, and make things happen in terms of equity and access for all students. It's a key thing. Tired of equity just becoming a buzzword. We really want to see action happen. So please join with us over at ace-ed.org. Okay, we'd appreciate that. You'll see our magazine over there. It's an online journal called AC&E, Equity and Access. And if you just click through on the icon, you'll enjoy a wonderful magazine we put together every other month. And when you join our consortium, we'll make sure and send you a copy of the new issue when it comes out. Again, ACE. -ed.org. Without further ado, let me bring on my new best friend from Camden, New Jersey, former home of Campbell Soups, the one and only Ron Miller. Hi, Ron. It's Larry here.
Hi. How you doing, Larry?
I'm good, man. How often do you get to Philly? Do you get across the river?
So I don't get to Philly. I haven't been to Philly for a little bit since our pandemic hit, but before that, I would get to Philly pretty often.
It's a good, you know, I'm so old, I remember when the Ben Franklin Bridge was actually called the Delaware River Bridge. That's how old I am. Okay.
That's all right. Listen, that's a good nostalgia for you. That's all right.
Yeah. The Walt Whitman hadn't been built yet. That's how old I am. Okay.
Okay. I got you.
I'll just put
good
that
frame
in.
Frame of reference.
It's a good frame of reference, okay? Indeed it is. Are you from Philly? Or are you from Camden? Or where are you from originally?
No, from Camden.
Okay. And, you know, Camden's now like a hot spot of learning as they redid the police and everybody's thinking about all that. People are talking about that, okay?
They are. I think that there's more to the story. I think that on the surface, you know, what you see in the city is you see some widespread improvement. But I think if you talk to the folks that live in the city, you'll get a various range of opinions, both positive and negative.
About the policing?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm sure that's good, okay, because we need the dialogue to make things better, because nothing's ever perfect, I got to tell you. Okay, but they are getting some, I'll say this, they're getting some good press. All right, and that's good for good old Camden. God, I haven't been there in years. For goodness sakes, it's been so long. I live up in Maine now, so it's been a long time since I've even been to Philly. All right, tell us about your blog, by the way, urbanedmixtape.com. Just go into that.
So, yeah. So sure, the Urban Education Mixtape, Urban Ed Mixtape, is basically something that was born from just my supporting teachers when I was teaching. I mentored a number of teachers, both formally and informally, and I found that there was some information that I thought that could help them with what they were doing, and I also did a number of professional developments I still do now. And so what the blog usually focuses on is just tools and tips, practical tools and tips for teachers that work in urban settings. primarily white teachers with respect to working with Black and Latinx students. So all that I put on my blog really focuses on just supporting teachers in that regard. There's also information for parents and even little tidbits here and there for students. But, again, it's mostly designed for those teachers working in urban settings, particularly white teachers.
Well, cool. And thank you for doing that. I tell you, it's going to be really appreciated. Did you teach in Camden?
Yes. So I taught for 6 years in the city of Camden, not for the district, but I worked for two different charter schools.
Oh, okay. What was that like in the charter schools? And actually, that's interesting. Wait a minute. The way you positioned your blog, I got the impression you taught in public schools. Okay?
No.
But
no.
You must have seen something or talked to people that encourage you to write the blog to help people slog their way through this. Okay, that's interesting.
I think what led me to writing again is just my experiences working with teachers and the number of questions that I would field, and certainly the experiences that I had working with teachers and sort of the things that I saw and how they interacted with students that really gave me rise to discuss it. And I think even more so with the professional development that I did, that really helped just give me the push to really, you know, put that information out there. Working in charter schools, there were some pluses and minuses. I worked in two separate schools, and one of the schools, there was a lot of autonomy with respect to what I could teach and how I could teach it. In another school, there was certainly a little bit more rigidness, if you will, if that's even a word, but a level of control in how things were taught and what were taught. And, I mean, all charter schools are created equal, right? They're not certainly a one-size-fits-all proposition, and charter schools go about doing things differently depending on who's leading them and where they're located and who they're servicing. So, you know, I don't want to paint all charters with a broad brush, but I do want to say that there are certain schools that are designed in a way to be a little bit more liberating, if you will, with regards to some of the subject matter that's taught and how that instruction is laid out. And certainly there are others that aren't, that are a little bit more confining, that are worried about compliance out of students and control of students.
Yeah, and while I'm on that subject, when you look at public schools, from your knowledge of public schools, and by the way, I like the freewheeling type of curriculum better, the kind that can recognize the kids whom they are teaching. We're going to talk about that directly. Do you see a problem, as you've researched this, in public schools? What's the challenge you see in that? Again, regarding cultural competency, which is the place I want to go with this conversation. What do you see with public schools?
So I think that the challenge that public schools have, or challenge that all schools have, whether they be, you know, charter, public, private, in the way of cultural competence, I think that districts don't always do a great job of integrating the actual meat and potatoes of what cultural competency is with the words of saying we care about, you know, our students and we want to give them the best education opportunities possible. When I look at schools, and currently I work in a public school, when I look at schools, I look at their curricula, right? As a history teacher, former history teacher, I'm always looking at that. I'm looking at, you know, what are kids learning about with respect to history, right? And are they learning the truth of history? But even if you're looking at all the other content areas, you know, what resources are you using? Are students of color, Black students, Latinx students, are they seeing themselves in the curriculum and the resources that you're using? Do they see people that look like them? Are you talking about people that look like them? Even from the standpoint of your instructional strategies, are you using things that are, or are teachers culturally fluent, right? They have an appreciation for they know who they are and their identity racially, but do they have an understanding about the culture of other people, particularly the students that they're teaching that are different from them? Can they utilize culture in a way to make it plain speak for students? Can they meet students where they are? I don't think that that's happening across the board. I think that there are a number of teachers that are doing that, but I don't think that all of them are. And even to a broader discussion, is your district culturally competent in the sense of understanding how the role that Black teachers, the role that Latinx teachers play in the lives of Black and Latinx students? Are they aware of, you know, just the impact academically that that teachers of color have on students of color? And there's research that talks about this. There's even research that shows that, you know, even white students prefer, in many cases, teachers of color. So again, when we talk about cultural competency in the context of just what happens in the school, no matter the school, I think that there are a number of districts throughout the country that aren't doing it right. Kudos to those that try, but I think that we have to get beyond, you know, trying. We have to try and make sure that we do this the right way.
Here, here, and well said, my friend. So let me take one step back. Let me ask two things. A, I'll just say it this way. Can a white teacher teach well to, I'll say, African-American kids of color? That's A. And B, because they're not African-American, they're not Latino. Okay, so can they really get the competence they need to teach culturally impactful things? Okay, that's A. And B, is the challenge in teacher training? That there are so many teachers, and I think what's overwhelmingly white, the profession, I don't know offhand, I'll say 85% white or something like that. You probably know the answer to that. Is teacher training reflective of what we need in a culturally competent teacher? Okay, you're on. Change the world. Go ahead, Ron. Go ahead. Change everything.
I'll start with your first one.
Okay.
I think yes. I think absolutely a white teacher can teach a Black student.
Good.
They can teach a Latinx student. You know, I don't think that's so much the issue. We know that they can. But if, like anything in the world, if you do your job the right way, you're going to walk away drained. And I think that, you know, if you do your job the right way, you're going to walk away not knowing any more than you did when you walked into it, right? So as a teacher, you know, you're constantly learning. You're constantly growing. You're constantly taking in new information to impart on your students. And certainly when you teach and you do it the right way, you walk away from that day just exhausted. And that's the job of a teacher. You know, you come in full, you leave poured out. And I think that there are teachers that do that. I think there are teachers that do that every single day. With respect to your second question, I don't think that it's a matter of training per se. I think that training is a go-to for a lot of districts. I think training is a go-to for a lot of people who are talking about doing these things, but I'm not sure if training is the way to go per se. I think that what we need for districts to say, we value anti-racism. We value that in our curricula. We value that in the core tenets of our school, policy, procedure, discipline. And if you, teacher A or B, cannot, you know, sign on to that, then, you know, maybe this isn't the place for you. I think when we leave it up to teacher training and when we leave it up to people to say, hey, this is what we'd like for you to do, that's no guarantee that it's going to happen. I think that it's going to take for districts to really say, this is who we are. We are this. Do you fit that? And if you don't fit that, then you can't be here. I think that districts have to take more of a firm tone with respect to that, because districts will take a firm tone with other things that they want to do. If they say that they want to create you know, initiatives around character, for example, and they're a character school, they will say that to their teachers and say, we value character education here, and if you don't value that, then maybe you don't belong here. I like to see the same sort of tone and tenor taken with respect to cultural competence, anti-racism. I think that that's important. I think that's the way that you really begin to fix these things.
I won't argue with you, but I have to ask the question. In my mind, there is and by the way, I'm a white guy from Philly. Okay, if to me, there's a difference between culturally competent teaching, all right, and engaging the kids and everything, and racism, and you kind of just put the two together, and just put is race. I don't even know how to ask the question, but where does racism fit into this? Maybe that's the easy way to ask the question.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm thinking as I'm talking. I think that the way
We
have to look at it, is just recognize that. So the social order that we live in, the social order is a white supremacist social order. And everything comes from that. That's the society in which we live. And so what we see in terms of race, unfortunately, this is where we are. And what we see in terms of racist policy goes to enforce the social structure. So when we look at schools, we can see policies that go to enforce that structure. For example, one of the policies that we're trying to break that down was the Obama era sort of discipline guidelines on how to discipline students in the attempt to roll back some of the disproportionate discipline that was happening to black students. And we see that the Trump administration rescinded that order. And so that's an example of a racist policy that happens in schools
there.
Where black students can continually be disproportionately disciplined. And how that matters is when kids are disproportionately disciplined, black students in particular, they're taken out of the classroom. Black students miss more time in class due to suspension more than any other race of student. And so now that those students aren't in the classroom, they're not learning. And so when they're not learning, they're unable to perform. And so when they're not performing, we will sit there and look at the students and look at their test scores and say, oh, there's something wrong with black students. What's going on with black students? Instead of saying, hey, what's wrong with our policy? What's wrong with the policy?
Right.
What's wrong with what we're doing, right? And so that's how racism plays a role in schools that have serious impacts on black kids.
That was a good answer, and I appreciate that. That put it in a rather excellent context, I got to tell you. So what's the answer here? And I know that's the broad question, okay? But where do we go from here? How do we make the change? Because most teachers, maybe you won't agree with me, but most teachers have a good heart, and they want to go into education to teach kids, okay? But we're realizing, and to me, here's a side we haven't talked about yet, it's extremely important to get it to engage kids with culturally competent with cultural education that's interesting to them, because we can engage them and they will become more engaged, and if they are more engaged, we can up the rigor, up the standards, because believe me, kids who are engaged can handle much more rigorous education. All right, and if we apply that, you'll see that those myths that are out there are, you don't have to lower the standards to teach black kids. Okay, black kids can handle high standards of rigor just like white kids can. Okay, but we got to give instruction and curriculum that's of interest to them. All right, and where are we on that in terms of rigor and in terms of just really engaging the kids? How is anybody doing it right?
I'm not sure. I don't have the pleasure of checking out schools, which I would love to do and just see, what's working, what's not working. I think that what the way that we can begin to do it right is understand what teaching is. And I don't know who said it. I've seen a number of people say it. There's a good brother down in Philadelphia. In fact, he's been in the press lately for all of the good work that he's doing, Sharif El Mekki. And I think I remember him saying something to the effect that teaching is political. It is. It's 100% political. And I would dovetail off of that and say the teaching is also prophetic.
Prophetic.
When you're
Did you say
teacher,
pathetic
prophetic.
Or prophetic?
No, prophetic. Prophetic.
Yeah, like a
teaching
prophet.
Is also
yeah.
prophetic. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And so I'll explain that. I'll explain that. When we say that it's political, for example, when you look at the terms racist and anti-racist, people will sit there and say, oh, I'm not a racist, right? And they're saying, I'm not racist. But that doesn't mean that they're an anti-racist. That just means
That's
that
right.
they're neither one or the other. And they're
That's
in
right.
the middle. And in the case of racism, you can't be in the middle. You're either for it or you're against it. And so the same thing is true when we're talking about teaching in the context of it being political. Either you're being political in one way or you're being political in another way. You can't be apolitical. Everything is political. From the standpoint of teaching about anything, you're doing it in a political way. If you, for example, teach math, right, and say that you just teach math in a way that is just giving them the facts, you're just giving them the information on equations or whatever it is that you're doing, and you're not attaching a purpose to it, well, then you're just teaching the math. And the political part of that is you're not using that math as a tool for those students to impact the world in a way that improves it, versus someone who teaches math in a way to say, okay, we're going to take these principles and we're going to apply them to what's happening in your community so that you can do something to improve it.
Agreed.
Right? Yeah. Now someone might not think that that's political, but it really is, because, again, either you're doing something for their benefit and the benefit of people, or you're doing it just to give them information. And if you just want them to get information, then whose purpose is that serving? That's certainly not serving their community. And that really matters with respect to black and brown people. Like, a Eurocentric view of education is education for education's sake, right? Like, the purpose is to be in the classroom and to get the learning, right? And that's what we're told, to get the learning. But for people of color in particular, black and Latinx folks, it's like, okay, the learning is great, but how can I turn that over to do something for my people? And when we don't do that, then we're being political in a different way. And so that comes to the point of being prophetic. Like, it's not about prophesying over someone and saying that they're going to be thus and so, but it's just to say, like, speak to the condition of what's going on with people and speak to how the education, whatever content you're teaching, can go to impact that community or those people in a better way. And we don't teach like that. If we taught like that, where we were being intentionally political on behalf of people and intentionally prophetic on behalf of our kids, then you would see the rigor improve. Then you would see the level of discourse, the level of work improve, because now it's like there's a purpose attached to what it is that I'm learning. People always get mad at kids when they ask, you know, well, what am I learning this for? What's the purpose of learning this in the depths? They're like, well, because you need to learn it. You have to learn it. I learned it. That's not good enough. It's never been good enough.
It's not just, I have to say something. It's not just these days, these crazy days, okay? And it's not just black and Latinx kids, okay? Teaching, in my opinion, a lot of it was always taught with no context to the world today, okay? Mm-hmm. And what you're suggesting, and I don't know how anybody could disagree with what you just said. Okay, the whole purpose of this is to make the world different. The whole purpose of this is to make every kid be part of their community, etc. Okay, and I don't know how anybody would argue with you on what you just said.
Well, and it's not just for black and Latinx kids, right?
Yeah.
It's for all kids. I mean, I think it's important for proper context, particularly with respect to history, to be taught to white students too. It's just as important. When people say, well, how do we stop what we see going on in the world now, right?
Agreed.
How do we stop for there to be bias? How do we stop for, you know, preventing racism and continuing sort of like breaking the generational curse, if you will, right? I think that part of that work involves teaching students the reality of our nation and how we got to this point.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more.
And that includes speaking to white students on that level as well.
I agree.
That often gets left out, but that's just as important as all the other stuff that we're talking about.
That often gets left out. I think it's more like always gets left out. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been left out. It's been left out for years. You're absolutely right. There's a Eurocentric view of all this, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you want to get your mind really changed, forget the races right now. Just read a book. I think it's called The Silk Road, about the history of Asia. Okay, it's a fairly new book. All right, and the line I remember the most in it, you know, the Huns invaded Europe from the east. All right, and they stopped kind of at Hungary. And people say, why'd they stop? And the answer was because there was no reason to go further. There wasn't much there.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Asia was thriving. Okay? Well, the, quote, dark ages, okay, is our history. Okay? We kind of forgot to teach the thriving Asian world, okay, in that case. All right? We do the same thing with everything else. We teach it from a Eurocentric point of view. So teaching a different set of history, okay, to me makes a lot of sense. It puts everything into a real context, and it makes things relative for kids. And if it makes it, well, I'm going to say it again, if it makes kid relative to kids, it makes the teacher allows the teacher to be far more rigorous, because believe me, those kids are going to be engaged. And that's a good question to ask you, okay? When you teach, or when you know people who teach, or people who follow what you're saying, when they go with a heavy culturally competent, I'll call it that, curriculum, and a culturally competent pedagogy, do they find that they can add more rigor to these kids, that these kids rise to the standards they expect? Which I think your answer, I hope, is going to be yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in my experience and a number of colleagues of mine, it's not so much creating something new, it's just integrating what already is into what the curriculum is, right? So it's you know, for example, literature. So, you know, don't get me wrong, I love some of the stories that I was, you know, told and read when I was in school. I'm a fan of Greek mythology. I love it, right? But I think that in addition to some of those works, we can incorporate other works from marginalized folks that aren't always included. And that's what I mean when I say you're not necessarily changing the curriculum per se. What you're doing is you're just making it more well-rounded so that students get a full view. And when they get that full view, just the fact that when you see yourself, right, that changes the way that you look at what it is that you're doing, because it's like,
bingo.
Oh, okay. And so I think that that's what I found, where students can begin to really ramp up what it is that they're doing, because now they're invested. You know, people always talk about students have to take ownership of their learning, but they're not going to take ownership of anything if they don't see themselves as part of it. How am I? I don't want to own anything that I'm not a part of. Right. And, you know, and again, ownership, the idea of ownership is really ultimately sort of a capitalist, like Europeanized concept. Historically, it's not a concept of people of color. I would say, you know, making learning a shared process where students are, you know, taking an active role in addition to the teacher. It's always teacher gives, student take, but it should be more of a collaborative process. And when people are upset about students not really taking that sort of leadership with their learning, well, are you giving them an opportunity to sort of talk about what it is that they want to learn? And have you heard that? And have you shared in that? So I think that that's how you get rigor, when you include students in the process and keep them in mind as you're going through the process.
Hear, student voices. Yeah, I always make the line, like Walmart doesn't go forward unless they ask the customers, okay, what they want, okay? And it's in schools, we have forgotten this, okay? And that's why student voice over the past few years has become hopefully more than a cliche and a catchphrase. But it is important. If you start to ask the customers, i.e. the kids, you're going to get a whole different view of what you're trying to do. And yes, we can teach kids to think, we can teach kids to find information, etc., but we got to guide them along, as opposed to spewing out information that might not be that relevant to them. Okay, we can make learning relative to them. So let me ask you this. Okay, Ron, we've got the pandemic. It's been a lovely year so far. We had George Floyd get murdered, okay, and we have all the social justice protesting, and then we have the pandemic, okay, so it's a lovely year, 2020, all right? But there are good things. I hate to say this, I don't want to dance on anybody's death, but there are good things that are going to come out of this, I hope. And I'm curious what you're seeing from your point of view, okay, that I think this has brought all these things, the pot has started to boil over. And we got to stop the pot from boiling over. Okay, so good things will come out of it. What do you see about that?
Oh, I'm to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure.
No, please. Okay.
I don't know. I mean, you know, and not to beat a dead horse, but you know, the young lady Breonna Taylor's killers have not even been arrested yet. So I think that
in Louisville.
In Louisville, I think that, you know, I'm not speaking about you, I'm talking about just in general, we can't lose sight of what we're looking to achieve when we see some of the sort of residual gains of the work that we've done. I think that for me, my concern is that, like all things, we get caught up in the emotion and the fervor of the moment, and then over time, it wanes out. And I think that's my concern, and I think that that's a concern for a number of black people.
So your feeling is that might happen yet again?
Yeah. Well, I don't think terms of people being killed, in terms of black people being killed by the police, unfortunately, I think that that's going to happen again. I mean, since George Floyd, it's happened, right? So I think that that's going to continue. What it's going to take is, I think, a courage that this nation didn't know that it had to really examine itself and ask the critical questions. Well, maybe we should defund the police. Maybe we should look at things like, you know, changing around the context of our society. Wow, maybe our society really is a white supremacist society. How do we go about changing that? I think that it's going to require a level. Yeah, I think it's going to require a level of courage that I'm not sure that this nation knows it has, and it's going to and what I mean by that is it's going to require for voices that are normally not heard or marginalized to be put at the forefront. And I think that there's a great fear. That folks will get left behind, and I don't think that should be the fear. I think that what black people are trying to say is that, you know, the fact that this nation is the way that it is has held everybody back. Even white people have suffered from white supremacy in a different way, not the same way, not a worse way, but there's their own struggle with that as well. I think that if we get beyond a place of, you know, what's going to happen to me if we do this, I think then we can get to a place where we can begin to achieve some of the things that we really want for our young people, for this nation moving forward. And my final point on it, I think that there's no way that you are going to eradicate racism and white supremacy if there is an unwillingness from white people to eradicate it. If there is a hold to whiteness, if there is a, I'm trying to hold on and maintain my whiteness because I know what it has gotten me and I don't want to be in this brave new world where I don't know what's going to happen to me, then we'll never change it.
Yeah, and I think the first step is to be able to talk about it, okay? And that's, I mean, people just kind of hide their head in the sand, and your points are well taken. What do you think in schools is going to change? That's your expertise. Again, we're in a crazy year, and that's why I'm asking it. Hopefully, we can make changes at the end. We don't make the same mistakes twice. What do you think?
I honestly don't know. I think the level of the lack of centralized leadership puts a lot of things in flux for superintendents and district leaders. You know, we haven't seen that much federal leadership on what to do, and certainly the governors are wanting to, I don't want to just say they want to pass the buck to pass it, but I think that they're nervous as well. So I don't know. I think that this coming year is going to be a tough year for a lot of people.
Oh, it is.
And
I agree.
I think, And I think that it's probably going to be one of the toughest years that, that educators, students, families have ever had to deal with.
Agreed.
And I hope, I guess my goal for is to mitigate as the as much of the damage that's going to happen as possible. And it's all the more important for districts to believe in anti-racism, because I think that what COVID has proven is that, you know, the impact that racism has had on Black people and other people of color, COVID has exacerbated that, and it's going to do the same thing in schools. And so it's going to be important for an anti-racist agenda to take shape, so that way those the impact of COVID can be mitigated. And if not, then there's going to be a lot of trauma that I think is going to be, it's going to take a lot of time to reverse.
Oh, I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree with you more. It's I think we are in a chaos stage right now, but I am just hoping, okay, that we learn from this, okay, and that we start to make move. You know, when I said at the beginning, we don't want equity, which is the other word that's bandied around, to be just a buzzword. Okay, I don't want, I'll say the word racism to come out as a buzzword. Okay, these are words that require action. Okay, and they have to happen, and they have to happen now. All right, it's that simple. It has to, it's enough already. All right, and hopefully, and I think school districts are trying. I really do think they're trying. But we got to really be aware of what we're doing and listen to the kids and make sure it happens. You're an interesting man, Ron Miller, I got to tell you. It's good stuff. It's good stuff.
Thank
keep
you,
up
sir.
The good work. You know?
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate
your
it.
Your thought leadership is important. So go make it happen. And certainly in Camden. What can I tell you? Are you, by the way, you said you're in public school right now. What are you doing now?
So there is a I run a after school and summer program that's federally funded, state administered. And so what we do is just provide enrichment activities for young people. I work with high school
nice.
Students. And so, you know, we provide them with all kinds of activities for them to do that they can take in and possibly turn into a career. We do a lot of career exploration with respect to our programs. And yeah, that's pretty much it in a nutshell. We're running our summer program. We're running our summer program remotely right now. We've had to trim back a number of classes.
Amazing.
And everything else, but yeah, we're pretty much, you know, doing what we do, and students, you know, they want the programming. I'm sure that they definitely benefit from the programming. So yeah, we're just happy to be able to provide it in the context of COVID going
on. And I hope
the
providing continues. The one fact I'll just say this, you know, which strikes me as amazing, when the pandemic hit, the federal government gave airlines $50 billion. Okay.
Yes.
Now they're asking schools to reopen. Okay. And the threat is they're going to cut federal funding. Think about that. One side gets $50 billion, and the other side, okay, education as usual. They're threatening that. They're not saying we're going to increase funding. They're threatening to cut funding. Okay. Think about that, and think about the equity issue of that. Okay, for people who can't afford private school. Okay, think about what's going on out there. It's just disgraceful. It's just disgraceful. And
it's going to impact a lot of students, unfortunately.
Oh, it's disgraceful.
Yeah.
And it really is.
Yeah.
But you got to keep up the good work, man. Keep your chin up. All right, it's good stuff. Again, remote summer programs. It's unbelievable. Ron, take it easy. Okay, you're a good guy.
Thank
I like having
sir.
You on. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
Thank you. Definitely did. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, and when you can, cross the bridge and get yourself a good cheesesteak, not a Pat's. Get yourself a really good cheesesteak.
We'll do.
Okay, be good, my friend. Take care.
All right,
bye-bye.
Take care. All right, bye-bye.
From Camden, New Jersey, that's Ron Miller and his really good blog. is Urban Ed Mixtape. One word, urbanedmixtape.com. Good guy. Okay. And from good old Camden, New Jersey, right across the bridge, okay, from where I grew up. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org and tweet it out over at EduTalk Radio. Please go over to ACE. Ron, you do this too if you're still listening. ACE-ed.org. Okay, and sign up for our equity consortium. We want your voice in there. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. You got another show coming up in about 45 minutes.